Hey guys, Alex Lokes here, and we are back in September. So back to school. We're just coming off of the summer. Hopefully it is cooling down a bit. The colors are going to start to change, so you should get that slide film out of the fridge and start shooting it. Now, within the film photography community, cameras change hands a lot. And around the table here at the Classic Camera Revival gang, a number of cameras have changed hands. So, in that theme, we're going to be talking about the cameras that have switched back and forth amongst the hosting crew. So, let's get started.
Coming to you live from Toronto, Canada, this is the Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to our show.
All right, so up first is a camera that we have talked about before. It's truly the pinnacle of Nikon Pro cameras, and that would be the Nikon F5. And on the selling end of things, we have James.
I am going to hit John over the head and take back my F5, so don't know how this recording is going to end, but I'm just kidding. The F5 is a spectacular camera. It is the camera on which all of the modern Nikon DSLRs were based, including the original D1X. And interestingly, Nikon's kind of kept their manufacturing track along the same line as well, too. Like, a lot of the like the F3 style, the F subs, like the FMs, FM3As, FAs, etc. If you look at today's modern Nikon cameras, you have the integrated body pro cameras like the D4s, the D5s, and then you look at the D850s, and you can see the parallels along the I guess the two part body designs, so the grip and the body design versus the other ones. But the F5 was kind of the first sort of big, beefy, fully integrated battery pack, battery module, I guess, if you will, in the bottom of the camera. This camera, you can buy an adapter, I believe, for it, and one of the you can buy one of the Nikon rechargeable batteries for it, or you can put six or eight AA batteries into the battery holder. I recommend going with the lithium batteries just for weight. It is eight batteries. Anyway, love the camera. Very well balanced, ergonomically like spectacular, incredibly fast autofocus, fully automatic. Like if you shot sports, this is the camera that you wanted. Of course, until the F6 came out.
But the F6 wasn't aimed at professionals. It was aimed at the professional amateur.
Yeah, it was a prosumer. But you know, very similar like to what Nikon does today, right?
Yep.
With the integrated professional body and then the two part body, but prosumer style body. But the F6 is in the Nikon's professional camera lineup as opposed to their consumer lineup. But I had no qualms about the F5. I loved it. If I wasn't such a Nikon fanboy and would stay up late at night dreaming about long walks with a Nikon F6 in my hand, being a total film nerd, dork, everything, you know, not talking to girls and just being a pimply-faced Nikon fanboy, the F6 is something I've lusted after my whole life. So not only did I sell my F6 to buy, or my, sorry, my F5 to buy that camera, what else did I sell? I sold a camera that we'll talk about a little bit later that Alex sold to me, which was the Pentax 645. I also sold my Minolta X700. Gosh, what else? I sold Crown Graphic.
And your Leica R3.
I sold my R3 with like...
No, actually, Leica Flex.
And the R3 I sold too. I got rid of all my Leica SLRs for the F6. And I had a beautiful SL2 system, like a really mint SL2. I had a Summicron 50, a 135, and a 250, I believe, all Leica R glass. And man, I Well, Alan Gaunt, who is one of our, hopefully listening to this.
He's part of the Toronto Film Shooters.
He's part of the Toronto Film Shooters. He's now the proud owner of that system, and I hope he's really enjoying it. I know earlier this year he got out to shoot some car, some Formula One car racing, or went to a racetrack to test it out, and hopefully he got some really great results.
I think it was more stock.
Or stock car. I don't know. I know he'd made a post about it earlier, but anyway, loved that system as well. But the F5 is, I mean, anyone wanting to get into modern film cameras without breaking the budget, you can find an F5 for under $500 Canadian. I paid $300, I think, $399 for that camera.
Paid $700 for mine.
I actually bought it from one of the local dealers in Mississauga that I deal with called Photo Creative, and Jeff Chevrier is the owner there. And anyone looking for high-end, like if you're a pro, this is one of the shops you want to shop at. He's a Leica dealer, an Olympus dealer, a Nikon dealer, Canon dealer. Doesn't really get into...
he's a camera pusher.
Well, they're all camera pushers, but like he caters to the higher end stuff, and he's really, really knowledgeable. In fact, he was one of the staff shooters for the Toronto Blue Jays during the 90s. So he took a lot of the famous World Series photos as well, all shot on film. And he's shown me some 35 millimeter blow ups of these things, a huge, like poster size enlargements, and they're incredible. But anyway, that's where I got that camera. It now belongs to John. I miss it. Like I said, if we don't hear from John in future podcasts, then you'll know what happened.
So, John, why did you get the F5?
James, put that knife down.
That's not a knife.
That's a knife. I rationalized my purchase of the F5 by the fact that I have a Nikon F4, my second Nikon F4 body. The first one was stolen. My current Nikon F4 I got pretty cheaply because it had a bit of LCD bleed in the viewfinder. It still works, but it's sort of irritating. And so that was my rationalization for buying the F5 body. And I have to echo pretty much everything that James has said. Ergonomically, it's automatic, I'd call it. It's transparent between your brain and the picture.
Oh yeah,
because you don't have to think about what you're doing. Beautifully balanced. I think it's actually, if I were to weigh it, I think it's heavier than the F4, but it feels lighter because the balance has gotten that much better. I like the fact that it has a diopter built in for my eye.
Yep.
Like the F4. Only thing that I don't like is that unlike the F4 and the previous F models, you cannot put pre-AI glass on. But I still have the F4 and the F3 and the F2 and the Fs for that. And you raised an interesting point about how it's the precursor for the digital.
You know, you could stop down meter with old glass on that camera too, right?
I'm not sure if you can put... I don't know if you can physically mount the pre-AI on... Like the F4, you can because there's a tab that you can switch. If it doesn't have the tab, if you try and...
For the notch,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, if you try and mount the pre-AI glass on a camera that doesn't have the switchable tab, then you can make expensive sounds.
Interesting.
And do some damage.
I should grab an old piece of glass and test it on my old camera.
Hold on.
But it's
noise of modern internet technology.
It's no big deal. Well, Alex was looking that up. The one thing I find it's funny is that for a lot of the cameras I have that I use, like I've got, you know, Kodak Metalist and Rolleiflexes where the experience is very, very, you know, unique. It's not like shooting a digital. And that's...
No, the F5 cannot accept pre-AI glass.
That's what I thought. The one downside to me of the F5 is that it doesn't feel like a film camera.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't look like a film camera either.
Yeah.
Especially from the front.
And so, now, it's great if you're going out shooting film and you want to fly below the radar, it's the camera to take.
Absolutely.
Like, if you shoot a Rolleiflex, you'll get stopped every 5 feet by someone saying, can you still buy film for your Hasselblad? So, at least with the F5, you're blending right in, for good or for not. But, yeah, it's an amazing camera. I won't be selling it anytime soon, that's for sure.
You.
No, I've actually taken the F5 on a Fuji Worldwide Photo Walk Day, and somebody came up to me and said, oh, what sensor do you have in it?
A new one every frame.
And I said, oh, and I took a look at their camera, and it was a full-frame digital camera. I said, oh, same size you do, miniature format. What do you mean miniature format? It's full-frame. I said, yeah, miniature. 24 by 36, miniature format. Why do you keep calling it? And then I pull up my Rolleiflex and go, because this is medium format. So, next on the list is the Contax 3A. Now, that is a camera that I picked up from John Meadows. So, John, why did you get rid of the 3A?
It was tough getting rid of the 3A because it's a beautiful camera with a very, you know, a classic, fascinating history, and of course, Zeiss glass. But for whatever reason, it tended to be the last one that would come off the shelf and go out with me. It just tended to sort of sit around and be lonely. And I felt the need to get a Hasselblad. Don't touch it, Mike. I know you don't like Hassies. And so I decided I want to get a Hasselblad kit. So I had to sell a bunch of gear to fund that, to try and keep sort of the zero sum thing happening.
It's like my bank account. Yeah.
The zero sum fund?
Zero fund, yeah. And so I sold it to Alex. Like, it's a beautiful camera. The meter doesn't work, but then most of the meter doesn't work on most of these. It's beautifully engineered. Certainly a brighter viewfinder than the old Barnack Leicas. It has a very wide rangefinder focusing base, wider than the Leicas of the time. So it meant for very, very accurate focusing. Just a beautifully engineered camera. And this is a win-win deal because I got my Hasselblad and I'm happy. And Alex will tell you he's getting a lot of use out of this camera and he's happy.
So the reason I picked up this camera is, if you know me, you'll understand why I picked up this camera. I do military reenactment as another very expensive hobby, but it mostly revolves around 19th century Napoleonic era, so 1815 and before. But I'd seen a lot of World War II reenacting, and I thought, man, that would be fun to do. But in Canada, it's very difficult and takes a lot of process to get a license to be able to purchase the firearms to do World War I, World War II reenacting, because these are pin-fired. You can get original firearms to do Canadian and British. And I was not about to do German reenacting for obvious reasons. So I thought, you know what would be really cool? If I did combat photography. The Americans had Robert Capa. The Canadians had the Canadian Film and Photo Unit during World War II. And I had gotten as a Christmas present Robert Capa's biography called Slightly Out of Focus. I highly recommend reading it. And I noted that Capa carried two cameras with him during D-Day. Contax cameras. So when I had the opportunity to purchase a Contax 3A, even though it was post-war, at 40 yards, the average spectator and even the average reenactor of World War II wouldn't realize that this is a post-war model Contax. So I thought, hey, you know what? This would be a fantastic camera to pick up. The price was right. It came with the 50mm lens. And I've since gotten a pre-war 50mm lens as well, non-coated. But again, this came with a lens hood, even though, again, completely and totally post-war. So this would be a fantastic camera. Now, unfortunately, I haven't been able to proceed beyond getting the cameras to do the reenacting and get the shoulder tabs needed. But hopefully I'll be able to work with some of my other reenactor friends who has gone on to World War One, have World War Two reenacting kits to be able to purchase the rest of the kit needed. And again, World War Two reenacting, not really big in Canada. There's a timeline event that happens at Fort George, but I've talked to some of the guys and they thought that it would be a great idea to, you know, bring a combat photographer along with them, with the added benefit that I'm not just shooting a digital camera, but I'm actually shooting a film camera as well, and using appropriate films like FOMA 200, FOMA 100,
even FOMA 400, you can get a classic 1940s look to your images. So, honestly, that's why I picked up the Contax 3A. Not because it was period appropriate, but it was close enough for reenacting work. So next up, we have the Pentax 645. Now, this was a camera I picked up fairly early on. Fantastic camera. I'm not going to speak ill with it, but like a lot of us around the table, I just wasn't using it. I had a Rolleiflex. I had a Hasselblad. Why do I need a Pentax 645? So ultimately, when I moved out of the house I was living in, when I got married, I needed to trim down the camera systems, and the Pentax 645, unfortunately, just didn't meet the mark. I often described it as my point-and-shoot medium format system, and I ended up selling it to James. So why did you pick up the 645?
Because I have gas.
Fair enough.
And it was a good deal. And, you know, I like to add, to echo what Alex said, I have every bloody format that there is out there. I have 6x8, like any roll film format, you know, other than getting into the ultra wide, like, you know, 6x12, 6x17 stuff. I don't have any of that type of gear yet, although I do lust after it. But the 645, actually, I made a decision to not shoot that format anymore, 645 in general.
Yeah.
Aside from that, I bought the camera because I wanted another 645 camera as a backup. I had a Mamiya 645 AFD, and I loved that system as well. Really, you know, quality, really good camera. The Pentax 645, you know, integrated back. It had a car, you know, you couldn't change the backs. You have to pull the film cartridge out, load up the spool, and away you go, which is fine. And if you wanted to get into, if you hit the rewind button and back in the 90s, let's say you were a prosumer, amateur-ish kind of wedding photographer, the Pentax 645 was a great place to start. Like, you know, low cost, excellent quality glass, just didn't have the tweaks and perks and nice little things that you get with a fully professional system. But for a consumer, terrific.
Well, that's just it. The Pentax 645 wasn't a system camera. Your motor and your prism was built in. Yep. It was designed as an integrated camera system. And the funny thing is, I thought I'd never touch 645 again, and yet I've sort of backed away from my Hasselblad because it needs service and have gone with a much more, oddly enough, reliable Mamiya M645 system.
And they're great systems. You know, for me, I think, like, if I want to go, like, into a larger format, into medium format, I want it to be significantly larger than miniature format.
Yep.
And basically, like, a 645 is essentially
A scaled up
35mm, yeah. And hey, there's nothing wrong with that, but I would much rather go 6x6, 6x8, 6x7, 6x9.
6x7.
Yeah, like 6x7 is, like, you've the Pentax 67, which
the print
I have,
format
is perfect. Like, it suits my eye. It's an 8x10 yep. when you're done. It's, you know, I think there's just so many, for perks. Me anyway, better options with a larger medium format than the 645. So I got rid of it as part of purging to make, you know, budgetary room
for fund the F6.
You know, I do miss 645 sometimes because it's, you know, it's nice, it's handy. Like, if you're going to go on vacation and you want something that's relatively lightweight and easy to use and you don't want to shoot, you know, standard, one, like a 135 smaller format, you want something a little bit bigger, 645 really works. And, you know, the systems aren't too heavy to lug around. So there are some good points about it.
Which is one of the reasons why I'm using the Mamiya for my current Canadian history project I'm working through. Yeah. And also, it gives you more shots per roll than a 6x6.
Absolutely. Like, yeah, you're going to get 15 shots out of a 120 roll.
Depends on the camera, but the Pentax 645 and the Mamiya M645 gives you 15 shots a roll. All right, so, Mike, you gave up a Canon FTB, so why would you give up such a beautiful camera?
Well, I kind of bought it at a thrift shop mostly because it was the back mount to Canon 50mm 1.4. And there was nothing wrong with the camera, honestly, but I had enough FD mount lenses or bodies that I really didn't need another. I mean, I had an A1, I had an AE1 program, probably had another AE1 body kicking around. I had my T80, a pair of them. Did not have the T90 at the time, so, I mean, I was pretty set for FD mount bodies. So it kind of just sat on the shelf. I put one roll through it and eventually put a second roll through it and just decided, you know what, I'm just not going to use this camera. And so I just put it out there, and sure enough, Bill jumped on it and says, sure, okay, I'll take another FTB, no problem, because why not? They're pretty solid cameras. They're mechanical. They work in all types of weather. And what's the worst thing that'll happen to it if you drop it? You might hurt your foot or you damage the camera, and honestly, for the price of them, you can't go wrong. They're a great body. They really are.
Yeah, so I'm the current owner of said FTBN. Of course, it didn't come with the 51.4 lens. It was body only. I got it for a really great price of $40, and I think some film. I can't remember. It was a few years back. I gave it an overhaul, and she's a nice performer. I've got a weak spot for FTBs, more so than the A-series Canons for some reason. I've written an article about it for the Film Shooters Collective, and I kind of consider them Canons sort of answer to the Nikkormat. Built like a truck, if you run out of film, you can use it as a handheld defensive weapon if need be. And again, it takes the FD, probably the TL and stop down, the breech mount FD lenses, and of course the last generation FDN lenses, and they all work great. It's got a match needle metering, there's not much you can really say negative about this camera. And again, they're very reasonable out there in the secondary market. If you're sitting on a pile of Canon FD glass and you're pondering, hey, I want to get back into film photography, but I don't want to try my luck with an AE1 with the dreaded squeal, give the FTB a look.
And, I mean, I've shot the FTB a grand total of a single time, and it reminds me of the Minolta SRT series.
Yep.
Same bulk, same control
and layout. Actually, the meter looks similar, too, because it's
match
sort of like,
needle.
Yeah, match needle.
Can't go wrong with a match needle manual focus. SLR is a first learning camera. Absolutely. Plus, the power switch is in a much better spot than the SRTs.
Oh, heck yes.
And the funny part is, when I sold the camera, I didn't even know the meter worked.
Actually, my repair tech got it back going.
So, moving right along, we're going into the Soviet bloc. And we have the Fed-2B, which at one point belonged to John.
And it's funny, we were talking, Mike and I, before we started recording this episode. I have to say, this camera did not make much of an impression on me because I don't even remember using it. I didn't even remember that it was mine. So, but I believe it's made more of an impression on Mike, so let's turn it over to Mike.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to say this camera's definitely made an impression on me. I mean, I had this camera.
Mike loves that thing. It's scary. Yeah.
No, I actually really do. I even have had a Leica 3A. And as I said, I had a Leica 3A. I took this camera, no problem, over the Leica. When I got it, was it in the condition it's in now? No, but it worked. Which pretty much that's all I really wanted. It was my first 35 mil rangefinder with interchangeable lenses, which I think that was one of the really big selling points for me. I had just an Instar 26M lens on it. Wasn't the greatest. It was kind of scratched on the front element, scratched on the back element, but it got me hooked on this camera. So I shot it for a couple years, really enjoyed it. And then one day I decided, you know what? I'm going to have a little bit of fun with this camera. What's the worst that happens? I screw it up. Big deal. Another $30. I got myself another one. I mean, they're awesome cameras and they're really easy to work on. Plus, if the rangefinder goes a little bit out of alignment, oh, well, they're actually really simple to pop the top on or pop the top off and align the rangefinder if you needed to. Although I don't actually think you need to really take the top off for the most common rangefinder alignment problem because there's just a screw there and you just use, take that off, another flat screw, smaller one.
True sign of a Soviet camera.
It is. It's unreal how fun this camera is to use. The other thing that I really liked about it was the single rangefinder viewfinder window, which the 3A did not have. And that was my biggest issue with that camera. It wasn't so much loading it from the bottom. That was a pain. You could get used to it. But having two different viewfinders, one to focus, one to compose, it was such a pain in the ass to have to switch back and forth. This one was the answer to that. Single window, I got rangefinder and composition all in one shot. But the prisms on this were fairly dirty. So when I had taken it apart, I completely cleaned all the prisms. I adjusted the rangefinder as I needed to. And then there was another part that I noticed about this camera. The top was all chrome. Inside, outside, everything was like silvery chrome, and you get a lot of reflection on the inside, and so you'd lose some of the contrast when you're focusing. So needless to say, when I cleaned that and did a bit of modification to this, such as I painted the body, so now it's almost completely black other than the bottom.
I see a chrome door and I want it painted black.
Yeah, I admit I did not change that, but I actually spray painted pretty much the entire body.
The panda model.
The panda model. All the parts that I wanted to stay chrome, of course, I masked off so that when I painted it, it was pretty solidly black back and front. I mean, this camera was a little beaten up. I'm not going to lie. The paint had already flaked off it. There's no leatherette. There's no grip tech or anything like this. It's just a metal body that's textured and easy to paint. But since the interior of the lid was chrome and it caused a lot of reflection, one of the things I noticed a lot of people would do was they would paint the top. And honestly, it's made a huge difference. I mean, just looking through the viewfinder on this now, it is gorgeous and is so clear. It's so easy to focus and it is a super bright rangefinder. It's probably one of the best rangefinder patches I've ever used. Save for James's M6.
Fantastic. All right. So if you'll remember back a couple months ago, we started talking about motion picture film. And we talked about Ferrania P30, but we neglected to talk about one of the most iconic, most, you've probably seen it but you don't realize it, motion picture films out there. And I'm, of course, talking about Eastman Double X. And this was the film that was used in Schindler's List. And if you watch the new version of Casino Royale, the opening sequence was shot on Eastman Double X as well. I love this film. If every black and white film could look like Eastman Double X, I would be a very happy photographer. I've taken this out, and I've thrown every situation, every developer, every lighting condition at Eastman Double X.
It's my favorite black and white portrait film, actually.
And it just takes it and runs. You develop it in Rodinal, you develop it in D96, you develop it in D76, you shoot it, you develop it in HC110, PMK Pyro, DK50. It gives you a cinematic quality that
it's so rich.
Oh yeah.
It's
absolutely.
I'm a big fan of dramatic, like film noir style, not film noir, traditional film noir, but yeah. Film noir like dramatic, deep, rich tonality for portrait work. And like, if, you know, if you look, think about your like your typical Hollywood black and white headshot, like black
double X.
Black cloth background, you know, standard, you know, typical lighting setup. So whether or not it's, you know, a Rembrandt light or whatever you're going to do with whoever, but you're going to light a face against a dark background. Eastman double X is like,
it's hands down
standard for that sort of thing. I just love how it's just rich. I wish they made it medium format.
They tried.
Did they try? Yeah,
they tried. They also tried in 4x5.
They tried 4x5 and it just did not work.
That's interesting. I wonder. I'm curious about that. But
I mean, it's probably the same reason why Pan F didn't work in 4x5. The emulsion just isn't stable that big.
Doesn't stable. I mean, yeah. But yeah, no. It's anyone that hasn't tried this film and really likes to shoot black and white. Yeah. You know, like especially like. Not broad daylight, but like, you know, evening, like, you know, just golden hour type of portrait work. Like if you're going to shoot stuff outside.
Open shadow.
Open shadow.
I recently shot it through Old Montreal. And if you've ever been to Old Montreal, the streets are narrow. The details are there in the buildings. And it just sings.
Oh, yeah. It's gorgeous.
I was lucky. John spotted me a roll, and I shot it through one of my Nikon F3s. It was like last year, last spring, we were up in the Junction, and it was one of those. It was a bright, sunny day. Like, I mean, not a cloud in the sky, and not hazy. It was pure, bright sun. And that
we get one of those once or twice a year in Toronto.
Yeah, truth of the matter is, actually, that film sang in that too. You didn't think it would, but it does. And I processed mine in HC110 B dilution, and I was extremely happy with what I got. And it's sort of like if I didn't have, oh, crud, I have Delta 100 in one bulk loader. I think I've got Rolly RPX 100 in another bulk loader. No, I've got Orwo UN54 in another bulk loader, another motion picture film, which I guess we'll talk about at some point. But yeah, getting back to double X, it's sort of, yeah, I wish it was available. And again, the 100-foot bulk rolls a little more easily other than, say, FPP's re-spooled 100-foot rolls.
I think Downtown Camera in Toronto also has it as well.
Yeah, Downtown Camera sells the FPP stuff in regular 35mm cartridges. Also, you can get it through Cinestill. I believe they call it just double X or something, and it's just all the same stuff.
Yeah, but I think your price point on the FPP stuff is going to be better.
Yep.
Than Cinestill. I find, like, I like Cinestill, you know, great company, great films, but their price points are just high compared to some of the other ones.
Mostly because they're removing the remjet from the color stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, the black and white, though, that should be cheap, because really, they're just...
There is no remjet on the black and white,
folks. Yeah, you just cut it down to size. You know, again, the lovely guys and gals at FPP, I just wish they had a 36 exposure cartridges as opposed to just 24. That's just how I shoot. So then, you know, when it comes time when a bulk loader becomes available, I'll probably buy a 100 feet of double X for that.
I think I have one roll left. I'm going to have to buy another roll because for the longest time when I was shooting it, I'd shoot it at that EI 250 and develop an X-Tall. That was a recipe I found. Then I checked out the recipe for T-Max Developer 1 plus 4 for EI 400, and I prefer it at 400 in the T-Max Dev. It actually is finer grained in T-Max Dev than it is in X-Tall. The tonality, I think, is a little bit smoother.
So EI 400
in T-Max 1 to 4.
Okay.
Well, T-Max is a compensating developer, so no surprise there. I've actually recently developed T-Max double X in D76, and I found it's heads and tails above every other one. It's about on equal with DK50, which unfortunately is a developer not readily available. Does Legacy Pro do a DK50 equivalent?
I don't believe so.
I don't think so.
Off my head, but it doesn't ring a bell.
No. Maybe they do a microdoll, but I don't believe
so. Formulary probably does.
maybe perhaps if someone can chime in from the community. Where Alex is checking the interwebs.
Because I did double X in Rodinal, and I mean, I love the results I got out of it. It was absolutely fantastic.
Nice winter shot.
I love that film. Now, of course, I know everybody at this table is going to hate me when I say that I've got a 70 mil bulk roll of it, which is great for 1/16 yes. film.
Formulary does a DK 50 equivalent.
There and you it's go.
Funny story, because I do have a 6/16 camera, spool, backing paper, so I think I'm going to have a bit of fun with this double X.
Well, that's about it for us. My name's Alex Lokes, and wishing you a fantastic fall, and we hope you had a great time at our fall gas meet too.
This is John Meadows. Until next time, if you have cameras to sell, hit us up. Probably someone at this table will be interested.
Yep.
Shut up, Mike. This is James Lee. It's have some fun and pass it around.
This is Mike Bataxi, and shoot some double X for your triple X.
This is Donna Bataxi, and get out there and shoot some of those fall colors.
Hi, and this is Bill Smith. I'm looking forward to seeing you guys at the fall Classic Camera Revival meetup in lovely downtown Cambridge, Ontario. And what weekend is that again, Alex?
Well, I hope you guys had a great time at the meetup.
and shoot a ton of slide film, because the fall colors are going to look great this year. Hopefully.
If y'all don't realize by this point, we record them 3 at a time. And for us, it's still Canada Day.